Hey, everybody, it's Andy. Welcome back to the North Point Community Church podcast. Hey, at the end of this episode, please take a moment to subscribe to our YouTube channel and download our free North Point app where you can access all of our recent message content. And actually, the app is the easiest way to share all this content with a friend, and it's the easiest way to keep up with everything going on around here at North Point. But most importantly, I hope the following presentation inspires you to take your next step in your faith journey. Enjoy.
Well, as we said from the very beginning, we think that a lot can happen in 90 days. Lives can change in 90 days. Our whole thoughts about the world can change in 90 days. And so as we started looking at the calendar, we realized from January 1st to April 1st, which April 1st will celebrate Easter Sunday, there are 90 days. And so we thought, well, maybe this is a great chance for us to go on a journey together, a 90-day journey from the birth of Jesus to the death and resurrection of Jesus that we celebrate on Easter Sunday. And so we've been looking at some different snapshots throughout his life. And last week we came to one that involved this lunchroom table, that involved the cafeteria where you and I can recall those moments where we didn't feel included, or we did feel included, or we didn't know where to sit, or we didn't know where to sit, and how shaping those moments can be. And I began to realize, the more conversations that I've had, that all of us have had this experience, and it doesn't just end when we're little. No, as adults, we're always, all of us are looking to find our people. Where's my group of people? Who are the people that I can call my people? And the danger with that is that when we find our people, we all of a sudden have defined who our people are not as well. And as we all think about who's in our circle, who's at our table, here's some things that I think are true for all of us, that we surround ourselves with people who like us. That's normal. All of us do that. And not only that, we also surround ourselves with people who are like us. More than ever before, our tables are becoming more homogeneous. They're becoming more common as far as values and virtues and the way we look and our educational background and our experience in life. And it's just natural for us to do that. But the challenge for all of us, particularly those of us who claim to be followers of Jesus, who put the fish on the back of the car, which that'll change the way you drive, or at least you would think it would. All of us know what it feels like to bump into something where we go, wait a second, that's not how I imagine God to be. And over again in Jesus' life on earth, he was encountering people who were turned off by the people that he was including. See, we actually learned last week that Jesus wasn't like that. He didn't surround himself just with people that looked like him, thought like him, and acted like him. And also, he wouldn't like us doing that. That's challenging to me. It creates some uncomfortability in me, I gotta be honest with you. And I would imagine with you as well. If you're not a Jesus follower and you're just checking out today, maybe you clicked on a link, maybe somebody sent you this message, or maybe you're here with a friend, or maybe you're down at Southside or one of our partner churches, and a friend invited you and they said, no, listen, these people aren't like what you think they might be. I would imagine that maybe you've thought before, one of the things that has turned you off about Christianity, perhaps, is the way Christianity, the way Christians have a tendency to create this bubble. You're in, you're out. I'm safe and you're not. I'm okay and those people are not. And Jesus, unfortunately, and fortunately, challenges those boundaries. And so today we're just going to talk about, we're going to push further into this conversation of how do we become the kind of people that are opening up our table to others? How do we become the kind of person that is showing kindness and mercy to other people that might not look like us, or might have different backgrounds than us, or might have a different view on life? How do we have a relationship with people and maybe even disagree over something? Can you have a dissenting view with someone else and yet still sit at the table together? Today, I want to talk about exactly how. How do we begin to do that? And it's not without challenge as well, and it's certainly not an easy thing to do. So let me just start with some Bible trivial pursuit. Some of you love this kind of stuff, and some of you do not. Maybe it reminded you of maybe growing up or something. But here's a question that if you have some kind of church background. Maybe you have maybe you've read a gospel account of Jesus' life before. Let me ask you this. Who did Jesus get most frustrated with? Who's the group of people that Jesus seemed to be pointing his finger at the most in regards to who they let in and who they didn't let in? The religious people. Yeah, it's unbelievable. It's unbelievable as a pastor to think that I would have been at the bullseye of who Jesus was most frustrated with. In the first century, Jesus was very, very, it seems even angry at times with the teachers of the law, the rulers of the synagogue, those who were leading the religious formalities. They're called Pharisees. In fact, this has become a term in our culture today, right? If somebody's known as a Pharisee, it's a derogatory term. It's not necessarily a positive thing. And so I want to read you some of Jesus's, some of his criticisms of this group of people. And as we do that, I want us to look at what was he so frustrated about? What were they doing that was bothering him so much? What did they miss out on that he wants us to pick up on? Here's one of the things he said in Matthew 23. In Matthew 20, chapter Matthew 23, there's all of these woes that Jesus is showing how woke he actually is. And so here's one of the woes that he says. He gives about seven woes to these Pharisees, and here's one of them. He says, "Woe to you, teachers of the law and Pharisees, you hypocrites." He calls them later on, he calls them a brood of vipers. Amazing. "You shut the door of the kingdom of heaven in people's faces." I admire his boldness, and it's a stunning picture of what he felt like that these men were doing. You shut the door in people's faces. You are a door holder into the kingdom of God, and when certain people come up, you slam the door in their face. And he uses this common title. He calls them hypocrites. What was it that drove their hypocrisy? What was it that drove their, "I'm going to do one thing, but I'm going to say another kind of life"? Here's something else he said later on in that chapter. He said, "You have neglected the more important matters of the law, justice, mercy, and faithfulness." He said, "You should have practiced the latter without neglecting the former." He said, "You make it a one without the other. It's all about what have you sacrificed? What have you given up? What have you done to stack up your good deeds? But in doing so, you have forgotten some very important things like mercy and justice and kindness and grace and compassion for other people." He said, "If you would have focused on that, you could have also done the sacrificing as well." And Jesus sets up this interesting relationship. In fact, earlier on in Matthew's gospel account, he said this. He said, on hearing this, Jesus said, and he said this a number of different places, but I love the picture that he gives us here. He said, "It is not the healthy who need a doctor." This is nothing against well checks. Well checks are fantastic, and all of us should go for one. However, Jesus is saying, it's not the healthy who need a doctor, it's the sick. He said, I've come for the people who recognize their need. I've come for the people who recognize that they don't have it all together, that they can't stack up their good deeds enough. And then he says this, I love this, "Go and learn what this means." And I would imagine there was a lot of attitude, you know, like one of these kind of things, you know? Like, "Hey, go and learn what this means." A lot of like head shaking, head bobbling. He says, "I desire mercy, not sacrifice." Nothing against sacrifice. It seems over and over again, was promoting a sacrificial way of living. But he says, "I don't love sacrifice at the expense of mercy." He says, "Go and learn what this means. I desire mercy, not sacrifice. For I have come to call, not to call the righteous, but to call the sinners." And at Jesus' table, over and over again, we would see him on earth sitting down with sinners. In fact, the Pharisees, the teachers of the law, they would scoff at him. They would mock him. They would make fun of what he was doing. They would say, "Look at who he's eating with. He's eating with those sinners." You just are reminded of the old church lady from Saturday Night Live, you know? The sinners. And see, we don't want to be called a sinner. That's a negative term as well, but when you think about who Jesus was around more, who Jesus seemed to like more, who Jesus was most comfortable around, he was around sinners a lot. This is good news for those of you that feel like a sinner. I think Jesus would have really liked you, and you probably would have liked him as well. But the Pharisees didn't like this because they were constantly measuring themselves against other people. Everything was relative. Everything was how am I doing versus how someone else is doing. And they stacked up their good works. Even mercy, even the process of receiving mercy for them, it was a sacrificial system where the only way you could actually get a hold of mercy, the only way you could have mercy applied to your life was if you behaved in a certain way and sacrificed enough one time a year at the synagogue, at the temple. You could take your sacrifices there so that you could then get mercy. And even the mercy that you got was because of your deeds. This term, being a hypocrite, another term for this is the term self-righteous. And the hypocrites were, the Pharisees were very self-righteous. They deemed themselves righteous. Self-righteousness basically means this, that because of my actions, I'm just better than most other people. And self-righteous people don't say this out loud, but it doesn't take long before you start to realize that a little bit of self-righteousness is in all of us, particularly church people. Now, pastors are immune from this, and they're not guilty of this, but most other people are. No, pastors sometimes are the worst at this. We naturally, followers of Jesus, naturally just start to stack up our legalistic ways so that we can feel like we're better, so that we can gain a sense of superiority. I'm just better than you because of what I do. I'm just better than you because of the way that I've lived. I'm better than you because of how my family is, because of my background, because of the lifestyle I'm living, and it just seeps into the way we see ourselves and feel about ourselves. It is extremely dangerous for Jesus followers. As we're going to find out, one of the reasons why it's so dangerous is because you can't have mercy if you're self-righteous, because mercy comes to those who need it. And if you're self-righteous, if I have any self-righteousness in me, then I don't feel like I need any mercy. There's no need for me to find mercy because I'm just stacking up my good deeds. See, self-righteous people are unable to see their need for mercy. And when you don't see your need for mercy, you will never find mercy. That the way mercy works is mercy comes to those who need mercy. I tried to summarize today in just a short phrase, you know, to give you like one takeaway. I couldn't find one, so I'm giving you three. Here they are all on one screen. You can't pass on something you don't yourself possess. This is what Jesus is saying. He's saying, hey, if you want to be a person that is showing mercy to other people, if you want to be a merciful person, you have to understand your need of mercy. And you can't pass on something that you haven't possessed. Another way to say it is, you can't extend what you haven't experienced. You will never be able to extend mercy to other people if you haven't experienced mercy for yourself. You'll never be able to extend an open seat at the table if you don't realize how amazing it is that you have a seat at the table. And then maybe to put it most bluntly, you can't give what you ain't got. You just can't. You can't give to someone else something that you haven't received yourself. And so today's really all about two things. It's all about learning how to become more merciful. And in order to do that, we've got to be people who understand how much mercy has been given to us. Because as soon as we lose that, as soon as we lose our view of mercy, we lose on how to treat other people. We miss out on the way Jesus would have us interacting with others. He says, go and learn what this means. I desire mercy, not sacrifice. I was thinking about the best way to illustrate this because I'm a simple person. And so I need it to come to life. I need it to be colorful, and I need it to be easy to understand. I had this seminary professor, Dr. Howard Hendricks, who he used to say, listen, Jesus said, go feed my sheep, not giraffes, okay? And so put it on a shelf where any one of us can get it. So I started thinking about what's the best way to illustrate this? What is something in my life that I didn't understand, I didn't know about, I didn't even know I needed it until I received it. And once I received it, it was so good, it was so real, it was so important that I had to pass it on to other people because of how much I loved it. And so immediately I thought of this picture right here. Some of you are unaware of what this is. This is a ceramic grill or a ceramic smoker, and that is the beauty of it, that you can, on a Saturday, your options are just endless. You can pick any meat, and you could go low and slow, or you could go hot and fast, depending on what you've got going on that day and what you would like to do with the meat that you're looking to prepare. This specific version is called the Big Green Egg, and I was a little, I was a little hesitant to talk about it because I thought, you know what, I would imagine with a church like as large as we are, which is so fantastic, there's probably somebody that sells Komodo Joe ceramic grills or smokers. And I thought, you know what, I don't want to make it seem like God is on the side of the Big Green Egg, you know? So I was thinking about those of you that are, because honestly, it's probably, you know, they're all probably real similar. Ceramic grills are probably ceramic grills. But those of you that maybe were feeling offended by that, you know deep down probably that this one is probably the best one. But so I was like, I don't need to say all that. So I struck all that from the notes. And anyway, but the beauty of this is that I didn't know. I had heard friends talk about it. I had heard friends that were a part of different online forums and would talk to each other about it and would trade recipes and would trade ideas. And Monday morning at work, everybody was like, what'd you do this weekend? You know, it's like, oh, I played with the kids. And then some were like, oh, I smoked a butt this weekend. You know, it was amazing. And I'm like, what are they talking about? And so I didn't know how amazing it was until someone gifted me one. Someone gave me one. I know some of you out there are going like, whoa, that's very expensive. Like, I'd like to have one, but I would never spend my money that way because I'm trying to be a better steward. And so just all that judgment, you can take it somewhere else because somebody gave it to me. They gifted it to me, okay? So I didn't even purchase it, which makes it even more of an amazing gift. I didn't know. I was perfectly content with the grill that I had. And then someone gave me this and I started waking up to the aroma of how beautiful this could actually be. And then I started loving it so much, it just started to become part of the vernacular, part of my language, part of my everyday, what I was talking to people about. I started realizing, oh, now that I have received it and realized the goodness, I can't help but pass it on to other people. And some of you know people like this, and some of you can think of your own illustrations, which you're welcome to do that. But the big idea that Jesus seems to be trying to clue us in on is, once you have tasted mercy, you may not have even realized how deep your need was, but once you have tasted it, don't you dare forget how beautiful that moment was when someone extended you something that now you want to let other people experience. Jesus actually gave us an illustration. Jesus was the king of illustrations. He called them, that we call them parables. The word parable, the Greek term, it has made up of two words, para and balo. Para is alongside. Balo is the verb, means to throw. So what Jesus would do is he would take a modern day story, a story that he knew would relate to that audience, and then he would throw alongside of it this truth that people could understand in their own way. And so he gives us one. It's affectionately known as the parable of the unforgiving servant. It's one of my favorite parables of all Jesus's parables. And so I just want to read it to you because the way he illustrates someone who has forgotten what they have received and how dangerous that is just absolutely challenging in a lot of ways. Here's the way he said it. Matthew wrote this down for us, and he said that Jesus taught this parable. He said, therefore, the kingdom of heaven is like a king who wanted to settle accounts with his servants. So you can understand that. This king had people that owed him money. And as he began the settlement, a man who owed him 10,000 bags of gold. Think about that. That's a lot of gold. You know, some of you have already translated that into Bitcoin. It's amazing. Thousands of bags of gold. It was brought to him. And since this person clearly was not able to pay, that's why it was a debt, the master ordered that he and his wife and his children, all that they had, be sold to repay the debt. This was very common. If the master decided, hey, time's up, the debt is due. And if the person couldn't pay, then the master will then sell everything they have immediately. Throw it all out on the street, auction it all off, and take whatever that is left and give it to me. And that's the only way that he or she is going to be able to repay the debt. And so at this, the servant fell on his knees before him. You know that song from the 60s that I ain't too proud to beg, you know? Sometimes when you realize how needy you are, it will cause you to do things that may have seemed embarrassing, but in the moment, you don't care because you're going, I will do anything because I can't pay. And so this man begged and said, be patient with me and I will pay back everything. Notice those words, be patient with me and I will pay back everything. Now the servant's master took pity on him. He had mercy on him. He felt compassion for him. And he canceled the debt. He didn't just say, okay, I'm going to give you an extension. He didn't just say, okay, well, I'll give you some more time to figure it out. He didn't just sort of absolve the debt. He canceled the debt and let this person go. But when the servant went out, he found one of his fellow servants who owed him not 100 bags of gold, but only 100 silver coins. So a lot less, a far greater amount than what this man had just had canceled on his behalf. Now, how should this man treat this person that he now bumps into? He just had hundreds of thousands of dollars absolved, and he bumps into a guy who owes him 50 bucks. How should he handle this interaction? Well, this is how the guy handles it. He grabs him and begins to choke him. Some of you are like, oh, he put his hands on him? Yes. Grabs him, chokes him, and says, pay back what you owe me, he demanded. Was he right in doing this? Technically, he was. By the law, he was not breaking the law. He said, immediately, pay back what you owe me. And look at what the servant does. His fellow servant fell to his knees and begged him, be patient with me, and I'll pay him back. What do you notice about that? He says the same thing that the guy just said to the master. But he refused. Instead, he went off and had the man thrown into prison until he could pay all the debt. Now, the awful thing is that when you're in prison, you can't even get enough work done to be able to make enough money to pay the debt. And so the cycle just continues. Now, you're not the only one who is appalled by this. Everyone else who was listening to this story was just absolutely appalled. Everyone else who heard about what this man had done was completely dumbfounded, and they were furious. In fact, Jesus goes on to say, when the other servants saw what had happened, they were outraged, and they went and told their master everything that would happen. How do you think the master is going to respond? Is he going to give him more mercy? Not this time. Then the master called the servant in and said, you wicked servant, he said, I canceled all that debt of yours because you begged me to. And then I love this question. Look at what the master asked the servant. Shouldn't you have had mercy on your fellow servant just as I had on you? You were just given mercy. Shouldn't you have had mercy on others? See, a couple of things could have gone wrong here. Either you didn't realize how bad your debt was and how great you just got it. Maybe you didn't understand. Maybe it didn't dawn on you. Or do you have mercy amnesia? Have you already forgotten the mercy that was given to you? The master's dumbfounded. How could someone receive something so significant and turn right around and fail to pass it on such a smaller level? So the master, in his anger, handed him over to the jailers to be tortured until he should pay back all he owed. Jesus goes on to say that, hey, this is how my Father in heaven is going to treat any one of you that has been forgiven. if you do not show mercy on your brothers and your sisters? What do we do with that? I mean, hopefully the goal is for all of us is to be a merciful person. How do you become a merciful person? Well, by understanding the amount of mercy you've been given. See, if you can't admit your brokenness, if you can't admit your need, if you can't admit that you were one time forgiven, that you were one time given another chance, that you were one time shown mercy, it's going to be hard to become a merciful person. And so either you never really understood, or maybe you just forgot. But reminding yourself over and over again of the mercy given is the way you then begin to turn around and show others mercy. See, until you fully experience the weight, the full weight of mercy, you'll never be able to extend the gift of mercy. Until you experience the weight of it, how significant it was, how undeserving you were, until you experience that, you'll never be able to pass on to others what you've experienced. But until you embrace your need of mercy, you'll never experience the weight of mercy. The only way to really understand how much mercy you and I have been given is to understand how bad we actually had it. What do we do, though? What do we do at the table when it comes to people that have done us wrong? Because I would imagine a lot of you right now, well, you're thinking, well, yeah, but you don't know my situation. I mean, how am I supposed to be an employer and demand that people be on time? Is it ever okay for me to say, hey, I love you, but you can't work here anymore if you continue to show up late? Is it ever okay for the government to say, hey, we're not going to continue to provide assistance? Is it ever okay for the DMV to close their door right when you show up at 5 o'clock, even though they said they were going to close at 5 o'clock? Is that ever okay? You may tell you the toughest place where I see this is as a parent. Those of you that have experienced kids who maybe have lived in a way that is contrary to what you believe, or lived in a way that you would say is detrimental to their future, or maybe you would say is just wrong or is just sinful, is it ever okay to say, hey, I love you, but enough's enough? How do you know? No, I'm literally asking. I don't know. How do you know? I'm serious. I don't know the answer to these questions. Are you serious? I mean, these are complicated situations in life. How much mercy is enough? How much mercy is irresponsible? How much mercy is too much? When do you stop? The answer is, it's tough to know, but Jesus is trying to make it as clear as possible. Listen, there are times, absolutely, as an employer, where you have to say, hey, you got to be here on time. Hey, you can't continue to steal from here. Hey, you can't continue to talk like that. Hey, you can't continue to provide assistance in that way. Sure. The hardest thing is as a parent, absolutely, there's going to come time where we say, you know what? Enough's enough. But Jesus says, but please don't lose sight. Even when you're in the middle of having to determine those difficult answers, please don't ever lose sight of the mercy that you've received. Because when you do, you lose your ability to treat others the way Jesus would have you treat others. So the question for all of us is this, is have you experienced the weight of mercy? Have you experienced the full weight of how bad it was for you? Have you experienced the full weight of all that God gave to you and to me? See, mercy is expensive, isn't it? I mean, as an employer, for you to do that, it will cost you. For our government, mercy is very expensive. As a parent, mercy is expensive. But we can't lose sight of the expense that God paid on our behalf. God allowed his son to give up his life. Because that's how heavy, that's how much mercy we needed. You know, every once in a while in the news cycle, there are moments that pop up where you go, oh my goodness, that is a stellar example of mercy. And maybe one of the most profound ones that I have seen in a long time happened just recently. Many of you saw the doctor that was charged with the assault charges against kids that was connected to the United States gymnastics team. It's one of the most tragic, one of the worst assault cases against minors in the history of the United States. Over 150 females stood up and testified, looked directly at him, and accused him of assaulting them. One of the first public accusers was a girl named Rachel Denhollander. And Rachel seems like an amazing person. She's married, and her husband have, it seems like, a couple of kids. She knows what it's like to be a mom. She has daughters, I do know that. And when she stood up in the courtroom to read what she read, it was unbelievable. Because she did not in any way diminish how awful what he did was. In fact, I feel like she brought even more weight to how awful what Dr. Larry Nassar did. But she also seemed to open up a pathway for mercy for him. Which, as I was thinking about it, I thought, you know what? If somebody cuts you off in traffic, give them some mercy, you know? If somebody tells you something that they shouldn't have said, and it was an even blatant lie, show them some mercy. If somebody drinks too much and makes some bad decisions over a weekend, show them some mercy. But if somebody commits that kind of heinous crimes against a child, I don't know. That's tough to think about showing this person mercy. I wanted to read to you just a very small little snippet of what she said. At the very end of what she read, the whole thing was about 15 minutes long, but what I'm going to read to you is just maybe 2 minutes long, but I want you to just listen to this. Toward the very end, she said, "In our early hearings, you brought your Bible into the courtroom." She was looking right at Dr. Larry Nassar and said, "You have spoken of praying for forgiveness, and so it is on that basis that I appeal to you. If you have read the Bible you carry, you know the definition of sacrificial love. It's portrayed by God himself loving so sacrificially that he gave up everything to pay a penalty for the sin he did not commit. By his grace, I too choose to love in this way. You spoke of praying for forgiveness, but Larry, if you have read the Bible you carry, you know forgiveness does not come from doing good things, as if good deeds can erase what you've done. It comes from repentance, which requires facing and acknowledging the truth about what you've done in all of its utter depravity and horror, without mitigation, without excuse, without acting as if good deeds can erase what you have seen in this courtroom today. If the Bible you carry says that it is better for a stone to be thrown around your neck and for you to be thrown into a lake than for you to make even one child stumble, you have damaged hundreds. The Bible speaks of a final judgment where all of God's wrath and eternal terror is poured out on men like you. Should you ever reach the point of truly facing what you have done, the guilt will be crushing. And that is what makes the gospel of Christ so sweet. Because it extends grace and hope and mercy where none should be found. And it will be there for you as well. I pray you experience the soul-crushing guilt so you may someday experience true repentance and true forgiveness from God, which you need far more than forgiveness from me. But I offer you that today as well. When I heard that, I just thought, what an amazing articulation of the goodness and the hope of the mercy of God, that none of us are ever too far gone. But it's also one of the most challenging reminders that that's the kind of mercy that Jesus is encouraging us to offer to other people. See, the question I think that every one of us should ask ourselves is this: am I a merciful person? Are you a merciful person? You might be right. You might be appropriate. You might be ethical. You might be lawful, but Jesus seems to demand, but are you merciful? There's going to come a time maybe where you have to draw the line. Enough's enough. Any more would be irresponsible. But are you a merciful person? Am I a merciful person? I'm more convinced than ever that the only way to get there, because for some of you, the only step you could take today is maybe just the first step. The only way to become a merciful person is to accept the mercy that's available to you and to me, is to understand the full weight of your need and my need, and to say yes to the mercy that's available to me. And then to remind myself over and over again that I was once shown mercy. And let that inform how I treat others today. I've asked our band to come and lead us in this song that I just think puts a beautiful exclamation point on this conversation. It's a song that basically says, hey, we have a God who says, in light of your past, not forgetting your past, but in light of your past, in light of your brokenness, in light of your need, he has offered mercy, because he's a God who delights in mercy above everything else. And so we can become people who go and do likewise. We can become people who try to live in the same way that Jesus has treated us.
Well, once again, thanks for listening. If you'd like some bonus content on this message and all the messages that we're doing between now and Easter, I want to invite you again to go to 90.today. That's 90.today and sign up. At 90.today, you'll find a host of different ways to engage deeper with our church and the extraordinary life of Jesus. We'll see you next time.